because thanks to the three of you, the Benzini Brothers' most spectacular show on Earth is about to rise to a new level of greatness. We are truly joining the ranks of the big shows, and none of it could have happened without you.
He beams at us, his cheeks so flushed I'm afraid he might burst into tears.
Oh, I almost forgot, he cries, clapping his hands in front of him.
He rushes to a trunk and fishes around inside. He pulls two small boxes out. One is square, one is rectangular and flat. Both are gift-wrapped.
For you, my dear, he says, handing the flat one to Marlena.
Oh, Augie, you shouldn't have.
How do you know? He says, smiling. Perhaps it's a pen set.
Marlena tears off the gift wrap, revealing a blue velvet box. She glances up at him, unsure, and then opens its hinged lid. A diamond choker sparkles on the red satin lining.
Oh, Augie, she says.
She looks from the necklace to August, her brow creased with worry.
Augie, it's gorgeous, but surely we can't afford...
Hush,
he says, leaning over to grab her hand. He plants a kiss on its palm.
Tonight heralds a new era. There is nothing too good for tonight.
She picks the necklace up, letting it dangle from her fingers. She's clearly stunned. August turns and hands me the square box. I slide the ribbon off and carefully open the paper. The box inside is also of blue velvet. A lump rises in my throat.
Come on now,
August says impatiently.
Open it. Don't be shy.
The lid opens with a pop. It's a gold pocket watch. August, I say.
Do you like it?
It's beautiful, but I can't accept it.
Yes, of course you can, and you will, he says, grabbing Marlena's hand and pulling her to her feet.
He plucks the necklace from her hand.
No, I can't, I say. It's a wonderful gesture, but it's too much.
You can, and you will, he says firmly. I am your boss, and that is a direct order. Anyway, why shouldn't you accept that from me? I seem to remember you gave one up for a friend not too long ago.
I squeeze my eyes shut. When I open them, Marlena is standing with her back to August, holding her hair up as he fastens the necklace around her throat.
There, he says.
She twirls around and leans toward her vanity mirror. Her fingers reach tentatively for the diamonds on her throat.
I gather you like it, he says.
I don't even know what to say. It's the most beautiful thing.
Oh,
she squeals.
I nearly forgot. I've got a surprise, too.
She pulls the third drawer of her vanity open and digs through it, tossing aside gauzy bits of costume. Then she pulls out a great expanse of shimmering pink something. She holds it by its edges, giving it a little shake so that it sparkles, throwing 1,000 points of light.
So, what do you think? What do you think?
She says, beaming.
It's... What is it?
Says August.
It's a headpiece for Rosie,
she says, pinning it to her chest with her chin and spreading the rest of it across her front.
Look, see? This part attaches to the back of her halter, and these parts go on the side, and this part comes down over her forehead. I made it. I've been working on it for 2 weeks. It matches mine.
She looks up. There's a small spot of red on each of her cheeks. August stares at her. His lower jaw moves a bit, but no sound comes out. Then he reaches forward and clasps her in his arms. I have to look away. Thanks to Uncle Al's superior marketing techniques, the Big Top is packed solid. So many tickets sell that after Uncle Al entreats the crowd to shift closer together for the fourth time, it becomes clear that this won't be enough. Roustabouts are sent to toss straw down on the hippodrome track. To keep the crowd occupied while this happens, the band plays a concert, and the clowns, including Walter, tour the stands, handing out candy and chucking tots' chins. The performers and animals are lined up out back, ready to start the spec. They've been waiting for 20 minutes and are fidgety. Uncle Al bursts out the back of the Big Top.
Okay, folks, listen up, he barks. We've got a straw house tonight, so keep to the inside track and make sure there's a good 5 feet between your animals and the Rube's. If so much as one child gets run over, I'll personally flay the person whose animal did it, got it?
Nods, murmurs, more adjusting of outfits.
Uncle Al pops his head back inside the big top, raising his hand for the bandleader. All right, let's go. Knock 'em dead. But don't, if you know what I mean. Not a single child is run over. In fact, everyone is brilliant, and none more so than Rosie. She carries Marlena on her pink sequined head during the spec, curling her trunk in a salute. There's a clown in front of her, a lanky man who alternately does backflips and cartwheels. At one point, Rosie reaches forward and grabs hold of his pants. She yanks so hard his feet leave the ground. He turns outraged to face a smiling elephant. The crowd whistles and applauds, but after that, the clown keeps his distance. When it's time for Rosie's act, I sneak into the big top and stand flattened against a section of seats. While the acrobats are receiving their applause, roustabouts run into the center ring, rolling two balls ahead of them, one small, the other large, and both decorated with red stars and blue stripes. Uncle Al raises his arms and glances at the back end. He looks right past me, making eye contact with August. He gives a slight nod and flicks one hand at the bandleader, who slides into a Gounod waltz. Rosie enters the big top, promenading beside August. She carries Marlena on her head, her trunk curled in a salute and her mouth open in a smile. When they enter the center ring, Rosie lifts Marlena from her head and places her on the ground. Marlena skips theatrically around the border, a whirl of shimmering pink. She smiles, spinning, throwing her arms out and blowing kisses to the crowd. Rosie follows at a fast clip, her trunk curled high in the air. August moves beside her, hovering with the silver-tipped cane rather than the bullhook. I watch his mouth, lip-reading the Polish phrases he's learned by rote. Marlena dances around the ring's perimeter one more time and comes to a stop beside the smaller ball. August brings Rosie to the center of the ring. Marlena watches and then turns to the audience. She puffs up her cheeks and wipes a hand across her forehead in an exaggerated gesture of exhaustion. Then she sits on the ball. She crosses her legs and sets her elbows upon them, resting her chin in her hands. She taps her foot, rolling her eyes toward the heavens. Rosie observes, smiling, her trunk held high. After a moment, she turns slowly and lowers her enormous gray rear onto the larger ball. Laughter ripples through the crowd. Marlena does a double take and stands, her jaw dropped in mock outrage. She turns her back on Rosie. The elephant also stands and then shambles around to present Marlena with her tail. The crowd roars with delight. Marlena looks back and scowls. With dramatic flair, she lifts one foot and plants it on her ball. Then she crosses her arms in front of her and nods once, deeply, as if to say, "Take that, elephant." Rosie curls her trunk, lifts her right front foot, and sets it gently on her ball. Marlena glares, furious. Then she thrusts both arms out to the side and lifts her other foot from the ground. She straightens her knee slowly, her other leg pointing to the side, toes extended like a ballerina's. Once her leg is straight, she lowers her second foot so that she's standing on the ball. She smiles broadly, sure that she has finally outsmarted the elephant. The audience claps and whistles, also sure. Marlena shuffles around so her back is to Rosie and lifts her arms in victory. Rosie waits a moment and then sets her other front foot on the ball. The crowd explodes. Marlena does a double take over her shoulder. She shuffles back around so that she's facing Rosie and once again places her hands on her hips. She frowns deeply, shaking her head in frustration. She lifts a finger and starts wagging it at Rosie. But after just a moment, she freezes. Her face lights up. An idea. She raises her finger high in the air,
turning so that the whole audience can absorb that she is about to outdo the elephant once and for all. She concentrates for a moment, staring down at her satin slippers. And then, to a rising drum roll, she starts shuffling her feet, rolling the ball forward. She goes faster and faster, her feet a blur of motion, rolling the ball around the ring as the audience claps and whistles. Then there's a wild explosion of delighted cries. Marlena stops and looks up. She has been so busy concentrating on her ball that she hasn't noticed the ridiculous sight behind her. The pachyderm is perched on the larger ball, with all 4 feet crowded together and her back arched. The drum roll begins again. At first, nothing. Then, slowly, slowly, the ball begins to roll under Rosie's feet. The bandmaster signals the band into a fast number, and Rosie moves the ball a dozen feet. Marlena smiles in delight, clapping, extending her hands toward Rosie, and inviting the crowd to adore her. Then she hops down from her ball and skips over to Rosie, who climbs rather more carefully down from hers. She drops her trunk, and Marlena sits in its curve, hooks an arm around it, and points her toes daintily. Rosie raises her trunk, holding Marlena aloft. Then she deposits Marlena on her head and departs the big top to the cheers of an adoring crowd. And then the shower of money starts. The sweet, sweet shower of money. Uncle Al is delirious, standing in the center of the hippodrome track with his arms and face raised, basking in the coins that rain down on him. He keeps his face raised even as coins bounce off his cheeks, nose, and forehead. I think he may actually be crying.
Chapter 18.
I catch up with him as Marlena slides down from Rosie's head.
You were brilliant! Brilliant! Says August, kissing her on the cheek. Did you see that, Jacob? Did you see how brilliant they were?
Sure did.
Do me a favor and take Rosie around, would you? I've got to go back inside.
He hands me the silver-tipped cane. He looks at Marlena, sighs deeply, and claps a hand to his breast.
Brilliant. Simply brilliant.
Don't forget, he says, turning and walking a few strides backward. You're on with the horses right after Lottie.
I'll get them right now, she says.
August heads back to the big top.
You were spectacular, I say.
Yes, she sure was good, wasn't she?
Marlena leans over and plants a loud kiss on Rosie's shoulder, leaving a perfect lip print on the gray hide. She reaches out and rubs it with her thumb.
I meant you, I say.
She blushes, her thumb still on Rosie's shoulder. I regret saying it instantly. Not that she wasn't spectacular. She was, but that wasn't all I meant. And she knew it. And now I've made her uncomfortable. I decide to beat a hasty retreat.
Hotch, Rosie, I say, motioning her forward.
Hotch, muy malutki ponchushek.
Jacob, wait. Marlena lays her fingers on the inside of my elbow.
In the distance, right at the entrance to the big top, August stops and stiffens. It's as though he sensed the physical contact. He turns around slowly, his face somber, our eyes lock.
Can you do me a favor? Marlena asks.
Sure, of course, I say, glancing nervously at August. Marlena hasn't noticed that he's watching us. I place my hand on my hip, causing her fingers to fall from my elbow.
Can you bring Rosie to my dressing tent? I have a surprise planned.
Sure, I guess so, I say. When do you want her there?
Take her there now. I'll be along in a bit.
Oh, and wear something nice. I want it to be a proper party.
Me?
Of course you. I've got to do my act now, but I won't be long. And if you see August ahead of time, not a word, okay? I nod. When I look back at the big top, August has disappeared inside. Rosie is perfectly agreeable to the unusual arrangement.
She plods along by my side to the edge of Marlena's dressing tent, and then waits patiently as Grady and Bill untie the bottom of the sidewall from the stakes.
"So how's Camel doing anyway?" asks Grady, crouching down and working on a rope. Rosie reaches out to investigate. "About the same," I say. "He thinks he's getting better, but I don't see it. I think he doesn't notice as much because he doesn't have to do anything. Well, that, and he's usually drunk."
"That sure sounds like Camel," says Bill.
"Where is he getting liquor?"
"It is liquor, ain't it? He ain't drinking that Jake shit no more, is he?"
"No, it's liquor. My bunkmate's taking a shine to him."
"Who, that Kinko guy?" asks Grady.
"Yep. I thought he hated working men."
Rosie reaches out and takes Grady's hat. He turns around and swipes at it, but she holds it high.
"Hey, would you keep your bull under control?"
I look into her eye, which twinkles back at me.
"Posh," I say sternly, although I'm finding it hard not to laugh.
Her great ear waves forward and she drops the hat. I stoop to retrieve it. Walter, Kinko, could use some softening around the edges, I say, handing the hat back to Grady. "But he's been real decent to Camel. Gave up his bed for him. Found his son, even. Talked him into meeting us in Providence to take Camel off our hands."
"No kidding," says Grady, stopping and looking at me in surprise.
"Does Camel know this?"
Yeah.
"And how did he take it?"
I grimace and suck the air in through my teeth.
"That well, huh? It's not like we had a lot of alternatives."
"No, that you didn't."
Grady pauses. "What happened wasn't really his fault. His family probably even knows that by now. The war made a lot of men go funny.
You knew he was a gunner, didn't you?"
"No, he doesn't talk about it."
"Say, you don't think Camel could manage standing in line, do you?"
"I doubt it," I say.
"Why?" "We've been hearing rumors that maybe there's money, finally. Maybe even for the working men. Hadn't given the story much credence up till now, but after what just happened in the Big Top, I'm beginning to think there might be a half a chance."
The bottom of the sidewall is now flapping free. Bill and Grady lift it, exposing the rearranged interior of Marlena's dressing tent. There's a table at one end, with a heavy linen tablecloth and three place settings. The other end of the tent has been completely cleared.
"Where do you want the steak? Over there?" says Grady, gesturing toward the open space.
"Guess so," I say.
"Back in a sec," he says, disappearing. A few minutes later, he's back, carrying 2 16-pound sledges, one in each hand. He slings one through the air to Bill, who looks not even remotely alarmed. He catches its handle and follows Grady into the tent. They pound the iron stake into the ground in a battery of perfectly timed strokes. I lead Rosie in and crouch on my hams while I secure her leg chain. She leaves that leg planted firmly on the ground, but is leaning hard on the others. When I rise again, I see she is inclining toward a large pile of watermelons in the corner.
"You want us to tie it back down?" says Grady, pointing at the flapping sidewall.
"Yes, if you don't mind. I don't think Marlena wants August to know Rosie's in here till he steps inside."
Grady shrugs. "No skin off my nose."
"Say, Grady, do you think you could keep an eye on Rosie for just a minute? I need to change my clothes."
"I don't know," he says, looking at Rosie with narrowed eyes. "She's not gonna pull her stake out or anything, is she?"
"I doubt it, but here," I say, walking to the pile of watermelons. Rosie curls her trunk and opens her mouth in a wide smile. I carry one over and smash it to the ground in front of her. It explodes, and her trunk dives instantly into its red flesh. She scoops chunks into her mouth, rind and all. "There's some insurance," I say. I duck under the sidewall and go get changed. When I return, Marlena is there, wearing the beaded silk dress August gave her that night we had dinner in their stateroom. The diamond necklace sparkles on her throat. Rosie is munching happily on another watermelon. It's at least her second, but there are still half a dozen in the corner. Marlena has removed Rosie's headpiece, which hangs over the chair in front of her vanity. There was now a serving table laden with silver-domed platters and wine bottles. I smell seared beef, and my stomach twists from hunger. Arlena's flushed, digging through one of the drawers of her vanity.
Oh, Jacob,
she says, looking over her shoulder.
Good, I was getting worried. He'll be here any second. Oh, heavens, now I can't find it.
She straightens up suddenly, leaving the drawer open. Silk scarves spill over its edge.
Can you do me a favor?
Of course, I say. She extracts a bottle of champagne from a three-legged silver cooler. The ice inside shifts and jingles. Water drips from the bottle's bottom as she hands it to me.
Can you pop it just as he comes in? Also yell surprise.
Sure, I say, taking the bottle. I remove the wire contraption and wait with my thumb on the cork. Rosie reaches over with her trunk, trying to pry her way between my fingers and the bottle. Marlena continues to dig through the drawer.
What is this?
I look up. August stands in front of us.
Oh,
cries Marlena, spinning around.
Surprise!
Surprise! I shout, twisting away from Rosie and popping the cork. It bounces off the canvas and lands in the grass. Champagne bubbles over my fingers, and I laugh. Marlena is there instantly with two champagne flutes, trying to catch the overflow. By the time we get coordinated, we've spilled a third of the bottle, which Rosie is still trying to take from me. I look down. Marlena's rose silk shoes are dark with champagne.
Oh, I'm so sorry, I laugh. No, no, don't be silly, she says. We have another bottle.
I said, what is this?
Marlena and I freeze, our hands still tangled. She looks up, her eyes suddenly worried. She holds a mostly empty champagne flute in each hand.
It's a surprise, a celebration.
August stares. His tie is loose, his jacket open. His face is an utter blank.
A surprise?
Yes, he says. He removes his hat and turns it over in his hands, examining it. His hair rises in a wave from his forehead. He looks up, suddenly, with one eyebrow cocked.
Or so you think.
I beg your pardon?
Marlena asks in a hollow voice. He flicks his wrist and sends his hat sailing into a corner. Then he removes his jacket slowly, methodically. He walks to the vanity and swings his jacket as though he's going to place it over the back of the chair. When he sees Rosie's headpiece, he stops. Instead, he folds the jacket and places it neatly on the chair's seat. His eyes move down to the open drawer and silk scarves spilling over its sides.
Did I catch you at a bad moment? He says, looking up at us.
He sounds as though he's just asked someone to pass the salt.
Darling, I don't know what you're talking about,
Marlena says softly. August reaches down and pulls a long, nearly transparent orange scarf free from the drawer. Then he weaves it through and around his fingers.
Having a little fun with scarves, were you?
He pulls the end of the scarf, and it slips through his fingers again.
Oh, you're a naughty one, but I guess I knew that.
Marlena stares, speechless.
So, he says, is this a post-coital celebration? Did I give you long enough? Or perhaps I should go away for a while and come back. I must say the elephant is a new twist. I dread to think.
What in God's name are you talking about? Marlena says.
Two flutes,
he observes, nodding at her hands.
What?
She lifts the flute so quickly their contents slosh onto the grass.
Are you talking about these? The third one is right.
Do you think I'm an idiot?
August, I say.
Shut up! Just shut the fuck up!
His face is purple. His eyes bulge. He trembles with rage. Marlena and I stand perfectly still, stunned into silence. Then August's face undergoes another transformation, melding into something close to complacency. He continues to play with the scarf, even smiles at it. Then he folds it carefully and places it back in the drawer. When he straightens up, he shakes his head slowly.
You,
he raises a hand, stirring the air with his fingers. But then he trails off, his attention caught by the silver-tipped cane. It's leaning against the side wall near the table where I left it. He saunters over and picks it up. I hear liquid hitting the ground behind me and turn quickly. Rosie is peeing into the grass, her ears flat against her head, her trunk curled under her face. August holds the cane and slaps its silver handle repeatedly against his palm.
How long did you think you could keep it from me?
He pauses for a second and then looks me straight in the eye.
Eh?
August, I say. I have no idea what—
I said shut up!
He spins and swipes the cane across the serving table, knocking platters, cutlery, and bottles to the ground. Then he raises a foot and kicks the whole thing over. It crashes on its side, sending china, glass, and food flying. August stares down at the mess for a moment, and then looks up.
You think I don't see what's going on?
His eyes drill into Marlena. His temple pulses.
Oh, you're good, my dear.
He wiggles his finger at her and smiles.
I'll give you that. You're very good.
He walks back to the vanity and rests the cane against it. Then he leans over and peers into the mirror. He pushes the hair that's fallen over his forehead back into place and then smooths it with his palm. Then he freezes, his hand still at his forehead.
Peekaboo,
he says, looking at our reflections.
I see you.
Marlena's horrified face looks back at me from the mirror. August turns and picks up Rosie's pink sequined headpiece.
And that's the trouble, isn't it? I see you. You think I don't, but I do. This was a nice touch, I must admit,
he says, turning the shimmering headpiece over in his hands.
The devoted wife, hiding away in a closet, sewing up a storm.
Or was it a closet?
Maybe it was right here. Or maybe you went to that whore's tent. Whores look after each other, don't they?
He looks at me.
So where did you do it?
Hey, Jacob, where exactly have you fucked my wife? I take Marlena's elbow. Come on, let's go, I say.
Aha! You don't even deny it,
he screams. He clutches the headpiece in white-knuckled fists and pulls, screaming through gritted teeth until a split zigzags across it. Marlena shrieks. She drops the flutes and claps a hand to her mouth.
You whore! August screams. You slut! You mangy bitch!
With each epithet, he rips the headpiece further.
August!
Marlena screams, stepping forward.
Stop it! Stop it!
The noise seems to shock him, because he stops. He looks at her and blinks. He looks at the headpiece, then looks back at her, confused. After a pause of several seconds, Marlena steps forward.
Augie?
She says tentatively. She looks up at him, her eyes beseeching. Are you all right now? August stares at her, baffled, as though he simply awakened and found himself here. Marlena approaches slowly.
Darling,
she says. His lower jaw moves, his forehead crumples, and the headpiece falls to the ground. I think I've stopped breathing. Marlena steps right up to him.
Augie?
He looks down at her. His nose twitches. Then he shoves her so violently, she crashes back onto the overturned platters and food. He takes one long step forward, leans down, and tries to rip the necklace from her throat. The clasp holds, so he ends up dragging her by the neck as she screams. I launch across the open space and tackle him. Rosie roars behind me as August, and I fall backward onto broken plates and spilled gravy. First, I'm on top of him, pounding his face. Then he's on top of me, cuffing me in the eye. I buck him off and yank him to his feet.
Aki, Jacob, shrieks Marlena, stop.
I shove him backward, but he grabs my lapels, and so we crash into the vanity together. I'm vaguely aware of tinkling as the mirror disintegrates around us. August thrusts me away, and we grapple in the center of the tent. We roll around, grunting so close I can feel his breath on my face. Now I'm on top of him, landing punches. Now he's on top of me, banging my head against the ground. Marlena is hovering, screaming at us to stop, but we can't. Or at least I can't.
All the rage and pain and frustration of the past few months is channeled into my fists. Now I'm facing the overturned table. Now I'm facing Rosie, who's pulling her leg chain and bellowing. Now we're standing up again, grasping at each other's collars and lapels, both blocking and landing blows. Eventually we fall against the entrance flap and land in the middle of the crowd that is gathered outside. Within seconds I'm hauled off, pinioned by Grady and Bill. For a moment, August looks as though he's going to come after me, but then the expression on his mashed face shifts. He climbs to his feet and calmly dusts himself off.
"You're crazy! Crazy!" I scream.
He observes me coolly, straightens his sleeves, and goes back into the tent.
"Let me go," I plead, jerking my head around first to Grady, then to Bill. "For Christ's sake, let me go! He's nuts! He'll kill her!"
I struggle hard enough that I manage to pull them forward a few feet. From inside the tent, I hear the crash of broken dishes, and then Marlena screams. Grady and Bill are both grunting, bracing their legs to keep me from getting loose.
"No, he won't," says Grady. "Don't you worry about that."
Earl blasts from the crowd and ducks into the tent. The crashing stops. There are two soft thuds, then a louder one, and then conspicuous silence. I freeze, staring at the blank expanse of canvas.
"There. See?" says Grady, still gripping my arm tightly. "You okay? Can we let you go now?"
I nod, continuing to stare. Grady and Bill release me, but in stages. First they loosen their grips, then they let go, but stay close, keeping an eye on me. A hand appears on my waist. Walter is standing beside me.
"Come on, Jacob," he says. "Walk away."
"I can't," I say.
"Yes, you can. Come on, walk away."
I stare at the silent tent. After another few seconds, I tear my eyes from the billowing flap and walk away.
Walter and I climb into the stock car. Queenie emerges from behind the trunks where Camel is snoring. She wags her stump and then stops, sniffing the air.
"See it," Walter orders, pointing at the cot.
Queenie sits in the center of the floor. I sit on the edge of the cot. Now that my adrenaline is fading, I'm beginning to realize how badly I'm hurt. My hands are lacerated. I sound like I'm breathing through a gas mask, and I'm looking through a slit formed by the puffed lids of my right eye. When I touch my face, my hand comes away bloody. Walter leans over an open trunk. When he turns around, he's got a jug of moonshine and a handkerchief. He stands in front of me and pulls the cork.
"Huh? Is that you, Walter?"
Camel calls from behind the trunks. Trust him to wake up at the sound of a cork being pulled.
"You're a bloody mess,"
Walter says, completely ignoring Camel. He holds the hanky against the neck of the jug and tips the whole thing upside down. He brings the wet cloth toward my face.
"Hold still. This is gonna sting."
That was the understatement of the century.
When the alcohol encounters my face, I jerk back with a yelp.
Walter waits, hanky poised.
"You need something to bite on?"
He bends down to retrieve the cork. "Here."
"No,"
I say, clenching my teeth.
"Just give me a second."
I hug my chest, rocking back and forth.
"I've got a better idea," says Walter.
He hands me the jug.
"Go on. It burns like hell going down, but after a few swallows, you don't notice so much." "What the hell happened anyway?"
Take the jug and use both my battered hands to raise it to my face. I feel clumsy, like I'm wearing boxing gloves. Walter steadies it. The alcohol burns my bruised lips, rips a path right down my throat and explodes into my stomach. I gasp and push the jug away so quickly liquid sloshes from its neck.
"It's not the smoothest," says Walter.
"You guys gonna get me out of here and share or what?" cries Camel.
"Shut it, Camel," says Walter.
"Hey now, that ain't no way to talk to a sick old—"
"I said shut it, Camel. I'm dealing with the situation here.
Go on,"
he says, pushing the jug back at me.
"Have some more."
"What kind of a situation?"
says Camel.
"Jacob's messed up."
"What? How? Was there a hay rube?"
"No,"
Walter says grimly.
"Worse.
What's a hay rube? I mumble through fat lips.
Drink, he says, pushing the jug at me again. A fight between us and them. Show folk and rubes. You ready?
I take another sip of the moonshine, which, despite Walter's assurances, still goes down like mustard gas. I set the jug on the floor and close my eyes.
Yeah, I think so.
Walter holds my chin in one hand and turns my head left and right, assessing the damage.
Holy hell, Jacob, what on earth happened?
He says, picking through the hair at the back of my head. Apparently he has found some new atrocity.
He pushed Marlena.
You mean physically?
Yeah.
Why?
He just went nuts. I don't know how else to describe it.
There's glass all through your hair. Hold still.
His fingers investigate my scalp, lifting and separating the hair.
So, why did he go nuts? He says, depositing glass shards on top of the nearest book.
Damn if I know.
Like hell you don't. Did you mess with her?
No, absolutely not,
I say, although I'm pretty sure I'd be blushing if my face weren't already ground beef.
I hope not,
says Walter. For your sake, I sure hope not. They're shuffling and banging to my right. I try to look, but Walter holds my chin tight.
Camel, what the hell are you up to? He barks, his breath hot on my face.
I want to see if Jacob's all right.
For Christ's sake,
says Walter.
Just stay put, will you? I wouldn't be surprised if we had company in a bit. And maybe Jacob thereafter, but don't think they won't take you, too.
When Walter's finished cleaning my cuts and removing glass from my hair, I creep over to the bedroll and try to find a comfortable place for my head, which is battered both front and back. My right eye is swollen, completely shut. Queenie comes over to investigate, sniffing tentatively. She backs up a few feet and lies down, keeping an eye on me. Walter puts the jug back in the trunk and then stays bent over, riffling through the bottom. When he straightens up again, he holds a large knife. He closes the interior door and wedges it shut with a chunk of wood. Then he sits with his back to the wall and the knife at his side. Sometime later, we hear the clip-clopping of horses' hooves on the ramp. Pete, Otis, and Diamond Joe speak in hushed voices in the other part of the car, but no one knocks and no one tries the door. After a while, we hear them dismantle the ramp and slide the outside door shut. When the train finally chugs forward, Walter sighs audibly. I look over at him. He drops his head between his knees and remains there for a moment. Then he climbs to his feet and slides the big knife behind the trunk.
You're a lucky bastard,
he says, working the chunk of wood free. He swings the door open and walks to the row of trunks that obscures Camel.
Me?
I say through a haze of moonshine.
Yeah, you.
So far. Walter hauls the trunks away from the wall and retrieves Camel. Then he drags the old man out to the other part of the car to take care of the evening's ablutions.
I doze, flattened by a combination of trauma and moonshine.
I'm vaguely aware of Walter helping Camel with his dinner. I remember propping myself up to accept a drink of water and then collapsing back on the bedroll. The next time I surface, Camel is lying flat on the cot, snoring, and Walter sits on the horse blanket in the corner with the lamp beside him and a book in his lap. I hear footsteps on the roof, and a moment later there's a soft thud outside our door. My whole body snaps into awareness. Walter scrambles across the floor, crab-like, and grabs the knife from behind the trunk. Then he moves beside the door, gripping the knife's handle tightly. He gestures to me, waving me toward the lamp. I dive across the room, but with one eye swelled shut, I have no depth perception and come up short. The door creaks inward. Walter's fingers clench and unclench around the knife's handle.
Jacob?
Marlena, I cry.
Jesus Christ, woman!
Walter shouts, dropping the knife to his side.
I nearly killed you!
He grabs the edge of the door
His head bobs as he tries to see around her. You alone?
Yes, she says. I'm sorry. I need to talk to Jacob.
Walter opens the door a bit more, then his face falls.
Ah, jeez, he says. You'd better come in.
When she steps inside, I lift the kerosene lamp.
Her left eye is purple and swollen. Jesus Christ, I say. Did he do that to you?
Oh, God, look at you, she says, reaching out. Her fingertips hover near my face. You need to see a doctor.
I'm fine, I say.
Who in blazes is that? Says Camel. Is that a dame? I can't see a thing. Someone turn me around.
Oh, I beg your pardon,
says Marlena, startled by the sight of the crippled body on the cot.
I thought there were only the two of you. Oh, I'm so sorry. I'll go back now.
No, you won't, I say.
I didn't mean to him.
I don't want you walking around on top of moving train cars. Never mind leaping between them.
I agree with Jacob, says Walter.
We'll move out there with the horses and give you some privacy.
No, I couldn't possibly, says Marlena.
Then let me take the bedroll out there for you, I say.
No, I didn't mean to.
She shakes her head.
Oh, God, I shouldn't have come.
She cups her hands over her face. A moment later, she starts to cry. I hand the lamp to Walter and pull her against me. She sinks into me, sobbing, her face pressed to my shirt.
Aw, jeez, Walter says again. This probably makes me an accomplice.
Let's go talk, I say to Marlena. She sniffs and pulls away. She walks out to the horses and I follow, pulling the door shut behind us. There's a soft nicker of recognition. Marlena wanders over and strokes Midnight's flank. I sink down against the wall, waiting for her. After a while, she joins me. As we round a curve, the floorboards jerk beneath us, throwing us together so our shoulders touch. I speak first.
Has he ever hit you before?
No.
If he does it again, I swear to God I'll kill him.
If he does it again, you won't have to, she says quietly. I look over at her. The moonlight comes through the slats behind her, and her profile's black, featureless.
I'm leaving him,
she says, dropping her chin. Instinctively, I reach for her hand. The ring is gone.
Have you told him?
I ask.
In no uncertain terms.
How did he take it?
You saw his answer,
she says. We sit listening to the clacking of the ties beneath us. I stare over the backs of the sleeping horses and at the snatches of night visible through the slats.
What are you going to do?
I ask. I guess I'll talk to Uncle Al when we get to Erie and see if he can set me up with a bunk in the girl's sleeper.
In the meantime?
In the meantime, I'll stay at a hotel.
You don't want to go back to your family?
A pause.
No, I don't think they'd have me anyway.
We lean against the wall in silence, still holding hands. After about an hour, she falls asleep, sliding down until her head rests on my shoulder. I remain awake, every fiber of my body aware of her proximity.
Chapter 19.
Mr. Jankowski, it's time to get ready. My eyes snap open at the voice's proximity. Rosemary hovers over me, framed by ceiling tiles. Huh? All right, I say, struggling up onto my elbows. Joy surges through me when I realize that not only do I remember where I am and who she is, but also that it's circus day. Perhaps what happened earlier was just a brain belch? Stay put. I'll raise the head of your bed, she says. Do you need to use the washroom? No, but I want my good shirt and my bow tie. Your bow tie, she hoots, throwing her head back and laughing. Yes, my bow tie. Oh, dear, you're a funny one, she says, going to my closet. By the time she returns, I have managed to undo 3 buttons on my other shirt. Not bad for gnarled fingers. I'm rather pleased with myself. Brain and body both in working order. As Rosemary helps me out of my shirt, I look down at my skinny frame. My ribs show, and the few hairs left on my chest are white. I remind myself of a greyhound, all sinews and skinny ribcage. Rosemary guides my arms into my good shirt, and a few minutes later leans over me, tugging the edges of my bow tie. She stands back, cocks her head, and makes a final adjustment. "Well, I do declare the bow tie was a fine decision," she says, nodding in approval. Her voice is deep and honeyed, lyrical. I could listen to her all day long. "Would you like to have a look?" "Did you get it straight?" I say. "Of course I did." "Then no, I don't like the mirror much these days," I grumble. "Well, I think you look very handsome," she says, placing her hands on her hips and surveying me. "Oh," I wave a bony hand at her. She laughs again, and the noise is like wine, warm in my veins. "So, do you want to wait for your family here, or shall I take you out to the lobby?" "What time does the show start?" "It starts at 3, she says. "It's 2 now." "I'll wait in the lobby. I want to leave straight away when they get here." Rosemary waits patiently while I lower my creaking body into the wheelchair. As she wheels me out to the lobby, I clasp my hands in my lap, fiddling nervously. The lobby is full of other old folks in wheelchairs, lined up in front of the bucket seats meant for visitors. Rosemary parks me at the end, beside Iffy Bailey. She is hunched over, her dowager's hump forcing her to face her lap. Her hair is wispy and white, and someone, obviously not Iffy, has combed it carefully to obscure the bald spots. She turns suddenly toward me. Her face lights up. "Morty!" she cries, reaching out a skeletal hand and clapping it around my wrist. "Oh, Morty, you came back!" I yank my arm away, but the hand comes with it. She pulls me toward her as I recoil. "Nurse!" I yell, trying to wrench free. "Nurse!" A few seconds later, someone pries me loose from Iffy, who is convinced I am her dead husband. Furthermore, she is convinced I don't love her anymore. She leans over the arm of her chair, weeping, waving her arms in a desperate attempt to reach me. The horse-faced nurse backs me up, moves me some distance away, and then places my walker between us. "Oh, Morty, Morty, don't be like that," Iffy wails. "You know it didn't mean anything. It was nothing. A terrible mistake. Oh, Morty, don't you love me anymore?" I sit rubbing my wrist, incensed. Why can't they have a separate wing for people like that? That old bird is clearly out of her head. She could have hurt me. Of course, if they did have a separate wing, I'd probably end up in it after what happened this morning. I sit up straight as an idea occurs to me. Maybe it was the new drug that caused the brain belch. Oh, I must ask Rosemary about that. Or maybe not. The thought has cheered me, and I'd like to hang on to that. Must protect my little pockets of happiness. Minutes pass and old people disappear until the row of wheelchairs resembles a jack-o'-lantern's gap-toothed smile. Family after family arrives, each claiming a decrepit ancestor, amid high-decibel greetings. Strong bodies lean over weak. Kisses are planted on cheeks. Brakes are kicked free, and one by one, old people exit the sliding doors, surrounded by relatives. When Iffy's family arrives, they make a great show of being happy to see her. She gazes into their faces, eyes and mouth wide open, baffled but delighted. There are only six of us left now, and we eye each other suspiciously. Each time the glass doors slide open, our faces turn in unison, and one of them brightens. And so it goes, until I'm the only one left. I glance at the wall clock. 2:45. Damn it! If they don't show up soon, I'll miss the spec. I shift in my seat, feeling querulous and old. Hell, I am querulous and old, but I must try not to lose my temper when they arrive. I'll just rush them out the door, make clear that there's no time for pleasantries. They can tell me about whoever's promotion or whatever vacation after the show. Rosemary's head appears in the doorway. She looks both directions, taking in the fact that I'm alone in the lobby. She goes behind the nurse's station and sets her chart down on the counter. Then she comes and sits next to me. Still no sign of your family, Mr. Jankowski? No, I shout. And if they don't show up soon, there won't be much point. I'm sure the good seats are already taken, and I'm already going to miss the spec. I turn back to the clerk, miserable, whiny. Whatever is keeping them? They're always here by now. Rosemary looks at her watch. It's gold with stretchy links that look like they're pinching her flesh. I always wore my watch loose, back when I had one. Do you know who's coming today? She asks. No, I never do. And it doesn't really matter, just so long as they get here in time. Well, let me see what I can find out. She rises and goes behind the desk at the nurse's station. I scan each person who passes on the sidewalk behind the sliding glass doors, seeking a familiar face, but they pass as a blur, one unto another. I look at Rosemary, who is standing behind the desk and speaking into the phone. She glances at me, hangs up, and makes another call. The clock now says 2:53, just 7 minutes to showtime. My blood pressure is so high, my entire body buzzes like the fluorescent lights above me. I've entirely given up on the idea of not losing my temper. Whoever shows up is going to get a piece of my mind, and that's for sure. Every other old bird or coot in the place will have seen the whole show, including the spec. And where's the fairness in that? If there's anyone in this place who should be there, it's me. I'll just wait until I lay eyes on whoever comes. If it's one of my children, I'll lay right into them. If it's one of the others, well, then I'll wait until... I'm so sorry, Mr. Jankowski. Huh? I look up quickly. Rosemary's back, sitting in the chair next to me. In my panic, I hadn't noticed. Well, who did they decide? How long is it going to take them to get here? Rosemary pauses. She presses her lips together and takes my hand between hers. It's the expression people wear when they're about to deliver bad news. And my adrenaline rises in anticipation. They can't make it, she says. It was supposed to be your son, Simon. When I called, he remembered. But he'd already made other plans. There was no answer at the other numbers. Other plans? I croak. Yes, sir. Did you tell him about the circus? Yes, sir, and he was really very sorry, but it was something he just couldn't get out of. My face twists, and before I know it, I'm sniveling like a child. I'm so sorry, Mr. Jankowski. I know how important this was to you. I'd take you myself, but I'm working a 12-hour shift. I bring my hands to my face, trying to hide my old man tears. A few seconds later, a tissue dangles in front of me. You're a good girl, Rosemary, I say, taking the tissue and staunching my leaky nose. You know that, don't you? I don't know what I'd do without you. She looks at me for a long time. Too long. Finally, she says, Mr. Jankowski, you do know I'm leaving tomorrow, don't you? My head snaps up. Huh? For how long? Oh, damn, that's just what I need. If she goes on vacation, I'll probably forget her name by the time she comes back. We're moving to Richmond to be closer to my mother-in-law. She's not been well. I am stunned. My jaw flaps uselessly for a moment before I find words. You're married? For 26 happy years, Mr. Jankowski. 26 years? No, I don't believe it. You're just a girl. She laughs. I'm a grandmother, Mr. Jankowski, 47 years old. We sit in silence for a moment. She digs into her pale pink pocket and replaces my saturated tissue with a new one. I dab the deep sockets that house my eyes. He's a lucky man, your husband, I sniff. We're both lucky, very blessed indeed. And so's your mother-in-law. Did you know there's not a single one of my children who could take me in? Well, it's not always easy, you know. I never said it was. She takes my hand. I know that, Mr. Jankowski, I know that. I am overcome by the unfairness of it all. I close my eyes and picture drooling old Iffy Bailey in the big top. She won't even notice she's there. Never mind remember any of it. After a couple of minutes, Rosemary says, Is there anything I can do for you? No, I say, and there isn't, not unless she can deliver me to the circus, or the circus to me, or take me with her to Richmond. I think I'd like to be alone now, I add. I understand, she says gently. Shall I take you back to your room? No, I think I'll sit right here. She stands up, leans over long enough to plant a kiss on my forehead, and disappears into the hallway, her rubber soles squeaking on the tiled floor.
Chapter 20.
When I wake up, Marlena has disappeared. I immediately go in search of her and find her exiting Uncle Al's car with Earl. He accompanies her to car 48 and makes August vacate while she goes inside. I'm pleased to see that August looks much as I do, which is to say, like a battered rotten tomato. When Marlena climbs into the car, he calls her name and tries to follow, but Earl blocks his way. August is agitated and desperate, moving from window to window, hauling himself up by his fingertips, weeping, oozing contrition. It will never happen again. He loves her more than life itself. Surely she knows that. He doesn't know what came over him. He'll do anything, anything, to make it up to her. She's a goddess, a queen, and he's just a miserable puddle of remorse. Can't she see how sorry he is? Is she trying to torture him? Has she no heart? When Marlena emerges with a suitcase, she passes him without so much as a glance. She wears a straw hat with a floppy brim pulled down over her black eye. Marlena, he cries, reaching forward and grabbing her arm.
Let her go, says Earl.
Please, I'm begging you, says August. He drops to his knees in the dirt. His hands slide down her arm until he's holding her left hand. He brings it to his face, showering it with tears and kisses as she stares stonily ahead. Marlena, darling, look at me. I'm on my knees. I'm begging you. What more can I do, my darling, my sweet? Please come inside with me. We'll talk about it. We'll work it out. He digs through his pocket and comes up with a ring, which he tries to slip onto her third finger. She jerks her hand free and starts walking. Marlena! Marlena! He's screaming now, and even the unbruised parts of his face are discolored. His hair flops over his forehead. You can't do this! This is not the end! Do you hear me? You're my wife, Marlena! Till death do us part, remember?
He climbs to his feet and stands with fists clenched.
Till death do us part,
he screams. Marlena thrusts her suitcase at me without stopping. I turn and follow.